Good evening, everybody. Welcome to this sessional meeting. Copies of the minutes of the ordinary general meeting held on 28th of February have been displayed on the Institute notice board and will be taken as read. May I sign the minutes as a correct record, please? I'd like now to extend a particular welcome to three guests. Dr. Sebastian Katowski, Policy Advisor, Natural Perils, Association of British Insurers, and an old friend, Paul Sharma, Head of Policy of the Insurance Division and Operational Risk Department, the FSA, and also Professor Stuart Coles from the Department of Statistics at the University of Padua, Italy. And I'd also like to welcome any personal guests and members who are here tonight. You are most welcome, and please feel free to join in our discussion this evening. Before we come to the paper, it's my pleasant duty to award a certificate to Gary Hemming. He's sitting looking very lonely in the front row there. Gary is the winner of the International Underwriting Association Prize for General Insurance, awarded to the best performing student in subject 403, and he won his award for the April 2004 examinations. So, Gary, I shall come round and present you with your certificate. We now come to the paper, The Modelling of Extreme Events by David Sanders, and I'd like to invite David to introduce his paper.
Mr. President, guests, ladies and gentlemen, extreme event theory is actually very modern. When I was at school many, many years ago, in my geography book, there was an obscure reference to a Mr. Wegener, who observed the shapes of Africa and South America were complementary, and this supported the concept of continental drift. This theory was dismissed as clearly a nonsense. However, by the mid-1960s, the theory of tectonic plates was being established, which led to a revolution in our understanding of many geophysical events. In the mid-1960s, Tom's theories of catastrophes was also being investigated, only itself to be superseded by chaos theory in the mid-1970s. This was encouraged by analysis, also in the mid-1960s, of unstable attractors, such as the Lorentz butterfly effect, where the proverbial flapping of wings in Peking created a hurricane in Florida. Mandelbrot's classic book on fractals also appeared. Thus, for 40 years ago, the scene was set for analysing and understanding extreme events. However, it wasn't until the mid-1990s that extreme event theories were finally well documented by Professor M. Brooks and his colleagues in their groundbreaking book. What I intended in this paper was firstly to draw attention to the profession in lay terms, the progress that had been made in modelling extreme events. To that extent, the key area is the generalised Pareto process. This worked because of the ubiquitous nature of many physical phenomena. Geophysical events tend to follow a Pareto-type process, and it thus follows that the GPD is a distribution that best fits the outcomes. However, it may be distorted by trends and cycles and possible changes in the parenthoods beyond certain critical points. For the actually using EVT analysis, one of the tricks is to try and find out what sort of trend or cycle there are by seeing what actually distorts the mean excess plot from the wished-for straight line. Using such analysis, a more complex picture can be derived using trends, cycles, and randomness. The second point is that the actuary, trying to understand the higher levels of excess of loss programme, be it property or casualty, should use the GPD as his first choice of distribution and to check the Pareto factor. The third point is that really extreme events cannot be managed through the insurance process. These include terror events as well as mega catastrophes. There are issues of social policy that need to be addressed, and the result will often be a joint public-private initiative. As Rousseau pointed out after the Lisbon All Souls Day earthquake, this is the price we must pay for civilization. The actuarial profession should have a valued input into this process. I have put a number of examples in the paper. There is freely available software to help the reader analyse their various data sets. EVT is of use to all parts of the profession, be it pensions, investments, life insurance, general insurance, capital projects, in understanding the potential cost of events and help focus how these costs may be managed or mitigated. Although Bobby Beard wrote on the subject in the 1960s, EVT has grown up in the last decade and is a very modern theory. My hope is that this paper gives insight into the theory and helps the lay professional appreciate the modern toolkit available. Finally, I would like to thank the number of colleagues who served on GISD working parties, without whose contribution this paper could never have been written. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I'd now like to ask Wendy Hawes to open the discussion.
Thank you, David. This paper gives an introduction to extreme value theory, something which has been with us for some time now, with the earliest papers definitely on the modelling side dating back to Emile Julius Gumbel in the 1950s. What the paper does very well is show us practical uses of this theory and also the mathematics behind it in an easy-to-follow format. The author creates a marriage between the actuarial problems we face and the pure mathematics behind EVT. I believe this is a relationship which, in general, is long overdue, and I think is something which we as a profession should be doing more of, especially given Morris's comments on our interaction with other professions. The paper is very wide-ranging, covering the theoretical mathematics, the types of models used, the events which it can be used on, as well as the public policy inferred by David. Although the paper, which is obviously based around general insurance events and the modelling of these events, the paper also gives examples and applications in all other areas of actuarial practice, something which, given the relatively low number of general insurance-based sessional papers, is highly generous, I think. I believe that the timing of this paper is exceptional. What are general insurance actuaries having to do at this current moment in time? Assess their capital requirements. And a part of that assessment is obviously formed by looking at events which are not normal, not necessarily extreme in all circumstances, but not what you would expect to see on a regular basis. Obviously, the type of extreme events mentioned in the paper are going to be of more interest to reinsurers for modelling purposes, as we would hope that primary insurers would be reinsured to cover such events. I know that our actuarial toolkit is already large in terms of what we can use, but who could argue that a method to estimate extreme claims can be anything but necessary in the current climate? Obviously, having the model is only a small part of the problem, the main problem being able to estimate the parameters for the model. As the paper points out, the parameters must be derived from the observed data points in the extreme, but by definition, these are likely to be very few if they exist at all. The paper, I think, summarises EVT in two easy questions which we can all get to grips with. What possible distributions can arise from the distribution of the maximum order statistic as n tends to infinity, And is it possible to formulate these limit distributions into a single formulation, independent of the choice of the distribution function? These two questions are then used to give the link to the central limit theorem, and that, of course, links to the pure mathematics behind everything. The paper raises many questions around the practical application of EBT. Where do you truncate the data, for example? If basic judgment is used, how does this impact on the results? What the paper also does is show reasonableness checks to use on these estimates via three very useful visual tests. On a more controversial note, the paper also looks at catastrophe modelling and states that CAT models tend to underestimate the impact of extreme events because the underlying parameters are based on normal events. If this is the case, should we be using such models to assess our capital requirements? I would like to put this question to both the author and the audience. The paper makes many references to the author's two gyro papers on this subject, one of which I was involved in. Both papers are highly entertaining and the presentations given at gyro even more so. Both papers detailed a wide range of extreme events and are well worth a read. One of the most exciting parts of the paper for me was the link between extreme event modelling and catastrophe theory, which is close to my old area of mathematical research. The stated links with self-organising criticality, I think, are thought-provoking, and I believe this should be seen as a good start to looking for other areas of pure mathematics which we can use in the actuarial field.
Now open to the floor. It would help me if those people who are planning to say something this evening could just raise their hand so I can see how many people we've got. Okay, so we won't need to bring down a guillotine in that case. Those of you who didn't put up your hands might wish to join in later on. You'd be most welcome. I have a few people who've notified in advance that they wanted to speak, so I'll invite them to speak first. And the first one on my list is Ivor Kenner.
Ivor Kenner. I was impressed by the straight line graph in figure 3.8. That's on page 17. Predicting earthquake numbers at various magnitudes between Richter 4 and Richter 8 in 1995. The y-axis is logarithmically calibrated. Even so, it is remarkable that a straight line graph should fit, never mind about predict. In paragraph 3.41 on the preceding page, we learn that the number of earthquakes of Richter magnitude m in a year is close to being proportional to 10 to the minus m, except perhaps at the extremities where there may be a very large number of minor rumbles or, on the other side, a few very large earthquakes. The Richter scale magnitude is itself proportional to the logarithm of actual magnitude to base 10. Using this, the above formula reduces to the simple rectangular hyperbola frequency times actual magnitude equals constant. This formula indicates that there is considerable stability beneath the Earth's crust. Paragraph 7.14 refers to global warming. There is indeed political and social deadlock between the vested interests and the alarmists. Actuaries cannot leave it at that. Global warming is continually taking place, fueled by the expansion of unrestricted road and air traffic, the expansion of industry, the wasteful burning of fuel and the destruction of forests, and the expansion of construction. Global warming is continually offset by the melting of ice and snow, which restores the equilibrium. On the whole, temperatures remain fairly stable. The ice and snow tend to melt at the weakest links in the chain. such as Kilimanjaro, rather than at the South Pole. Nobody knows how much ice and snow have to melt to counterbalance global warming. Nobody knows how much extra water is going into the world's oceans and seas as a result. There's enormous pressure at the bottom of the ocean. Despite this, the situation down there is generally in equilibrium. Any rise in the amount of water in the ocean will increase that pressure. We need go no further than the Encyclopedia Britannica to find out what happens next. Higher pressure distorts the delicate equilibrium which exists on the ocean bed, particularly where the Earth's crust is fragile, for example, along the fault lines which exist off the northwest coast of Sumatra. A strain builds up on the Earth's crust, which bends out of shape. Cracks develop, water flows in, and there's an unstable deformation in the fault zone. When the water reaches the hot underground area, it is heated, forcing up the Earth's surface. There's an underwater earthquake, which occasionally leads to a visible tsunami. Afterwards, there's a sudden drop in stress in the ocean bed, followed by some aftershocks. Following this, a new state of equilibrium emerges. The Boxing Day 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake was 9.3 on the Richter scale. They do come larger than that in Kyrgyzstan, for example, where you have them 10 or 11, but they're not underwater in Kyrgyzstan. Nevertheless, the extent of the Indian Ocean earthquake's effects was unprecedented. I don't think anything previously had reached to the shores of Sri Lanka. Its magnitude was unpredictable. Returning now to the formula, frequency times actual magnitude equals constant. It is clear that a simple way of finding out whether earthquakes are getting larger and more frequent is to calculate the constant for successive years. As in many other fields, though, actuaries need to pay as much attention to processes as they already do to events. Thank you.
Alex Markerson.
I want to thank the author first for his interesting and thought-provoking paper. The matter is important and topical in the current regulatory environment, and the area of risk in extreme situations is an extremely challenging one that merits serious attention from actuaries, while tempered by care that we contribute where we add value to our clients rather than serve to generate panic, complacency or confusion. The adage of garbage in, garbage out could not be more apt than here. Garbage in, because a judgment as to how we treat our data, and there are numerous ones we make explicitly or implicitly as we carry out our work, is magnified to a differing order of magnitude at these statistical outer reaches that we are considering today. Regulators are rightly sceptical of insurers picking heavy-tailed distributions simply on the basis that this approach has to be the right thing to use. To outline the problems, first, their selection is of a necessity based on scant or non-existent data. Benchmarking may supply little comfort here when the pool of events is small and the nature of risks evolving over time, if what benchmarking leads to is capital setting by consensus. Also, there's the potential that by using these statistical models could be used to justify a desired level of capital rather than to test or to estimate it. As a profession, we need to consider how best to manage the risk that this presents to us. Garbage out, because too often we appear to be building simulation models with little grasp of even the random sampling error these models entail. Anyone who has glibly built a DFA model using heavy tail distributions or strong statistical tail dependencies, or selected a tail value at risk or an expected policyholder deficit measure without running enough simulations, or indeed considering the systems implications of doing so, may need to take a deep breath. Random error is always quoted as the simplest and easiest element of uncertainty to cope with. This probably remains true, but easiest does not mean easy. Fortunately, actuaries have demonstrated that they add value to their clients by doing more than blindly applying statistics, by understanding the processes underlying the financial systems they're modelling, the macroeconomic drivers, the causal relationships, the accounting treatments, the information flows. We need to ensure that when we employ these models, such as those outlined in the paper, the framework work that we adopt forces us to ask the tough questions needed, and we develop our responses appropriately. If necessary, recasting the problem to achieve this. Our methodology should be improving understanding of uncertainty rather than clouding it. At present, the general insurance arm of the profession is wrestling with if and how uncertainty should be presented when we consider the work we undertake in the field of reserving. We must not lose sight of how these arguments flow through to our work in pricing, capital modelling, or other areas if we are to maintain credibility in the eyes of our customers and the public at large. Thank you.
We've had a written contribution from Andrew Smith, and I'll now ask the Honorary Secretary, Adrian Saunders, to read it out to us.
There's a contribution from Andrew Smith. Most of this paper is concerned with fitting distributions to extreme event data. There are useful recipes for fitting extreme value distributions, generalised Pareto distributions, and power laws. Indeed, many insurers routinely fit power law curves to historic extreme events as a starting point for stochastic future projections. It is the nature of extreme events that data is scarce. As a result, there is a good chance that your parameter estimates are wrong or that the model itself is inappropriate. The curse of extreme events is that if one occurs in your data set, then it is overrepresented, and if none occurs, then it is underrepresented. As a result, estimated parameters can fluctuate wildly as new experience emerges. For example, let us consider a model calibrated to 5 data points of losses above a threshold. On the basis of these 5 losses, extreme events are believed to have a mean of £10 and a standard deviation of £20. An analyst fits a Pareto distribution and establishes that the 1 in 200-year event is a loss of £105. Now suppose that event actually occurs. In addition to the loss of £105, the firm must recalibrate their model. A recalibrated distribution, allowing for the new loss, could now imply a 1 in 200 event of £240. Capital requirements increase, and the extra capital we have to find is even greater than the loss that prompted the recalibration. The actuary may well adopt a pragmatic approach that softens the impact of the new data point, precisely the discussion that many London market insurers are now having regarding the September 2001 losses. I would welcome professional guidance to ensure that such pragmatism could not be misconstrued as ignoring awkward data. Sanders' paper draws heavily on extremal type theorems such as Fisher-Tippett in section 3.10 and Pickland's Balkema-Dahan, section 319. These theorems characterise the limiting behaviour of extreme events. Regrettably, today's paper does not quote these theorems in full. It cites the conclusion, but not the underlying hypotheses needed to make the conclusion hold. Even when the limiting theorem does hold for infinite sample sizes, it is useful to discuss how bad the approximations can be when data is limited. Take the central limit theorem example in 3.7. To use this result in practice, we need to know how quickly the normal limit is approached. For example, if we had only 1 million independent observations of SN, could we rely on the sum being normal? Certainly not if each of the SN has a Poisson distribution with a mean of 1 millionth. In that case, the sum would be Poisson with mean 1. Instead of the central limit theorem, consider the limiting maximum distribution in section 3.8. Suppose the xn are normally distributed. Then, contrary to the claim in 3.10, the maximum does not have an extreme value distribution, because there is no limiting distribution at all. Suppose instead that the xn are log normal or Weibull. Then the same problem arises, no limiting distribution. When you've eliminated these and all the other distributions where Fisher-Tippett theorem does not apply, there's not much left. All you've really proved is that exponentially tailed distributions have exponential tails, and power law distributions have power law tails, which is perfectly true, but not much help in choosing a distribution for extreme events. I could prove a theorem that log-normal distributions have log-normal tails, but that doesn't make every data set log-normal. For this reason, it is important to state and verify the underlying hypotheses when applying extremal type theorems. Paul Embrex and his team at Zurich have performed a great service to actuaries in developing and promoting extreme value tools. Tonight's creditably brief paper follows their work closely. But there is more to extreme events than extreme value theory. I believe actuaries could usefully cast their nets more widely. For example, there is a huge literature on large deviations, starting with the 1979 book by Friedlin and Wenzel. The literature includes not only many families of distributions, but also useful limit theorems, analytical tools, asymptotic theorems, statistical sampling analysis, numerical methods, and simulation variance reduction tools. And Andrew then lists a number of useful reference books at the end of his note, which I'm not going to read out because one of them at least is in Russian.
Thank you, Adrian. It will appear in the journal in due course. Whether it appears in Russian, I don't know. Professor Coles, would you like to...
I feel a bit exposed. I'm a statistician, I'm not an actuary. Thank you very much for the invitation to be here. It's a pleasure. My background is that I'm a researcher, a statistics researcher, and pretty much all of my academic research has been in the field of extreme value theory, but more on the modelling side than the theoretical development side. So my comments are really from a statistical perspective on the presentation that David's made. I really wanted to say that I thought it was an excellent paper in terms of emphasising the potential role of extreme value theory in what I perceive to be your science. I thought the point was very well made. I thought the examples were well chosen, and the connection between the theoretical work and the potential applications was very lucidly made. I also like the paper for its emphasis on the limitations of what one might think of as rather more standard models in this context, normal-based models, which in other disciplines as well as your own have been shown to be extremely wanting when applied for extreme value analysis. And I also thought presentation of the basic theory on extremes was nicely presented for a lay audience in this subject. I do think it's worth emphasising some limitations of the theory itself, though. These are asymptotically developed models. I think they do have a wider role than the written contribution suggested. I think there is they have a broader broader justification than that that contribution suggested. Nonetheless, they are based on theoretical assumptions, which in practice are uncheckable. Some checks can be made, and David made some illustrations with various graphical plots to check that within the range of available data, the models do have some quality of fit. But of course, for extrapolation, which is where these models are used for, by definition, there's no real way of checking until we get more extreme data. So the point is they are based on rather strong assumptions. The question is, if you don't make those assumptions, what can you do? By definition, some kind of extrapolation has to be made. And my own feeling on the subject is that in the absence of alternative methods, these models provide the most natural starting point. However, it is a starting point, and my own limited contribution to the area has been in the field of really using extreme value models, not per se, but using them as part of a broader toolkit of techniques, by which I mean, as David said himself, the models themselves are based on very simplistic assumptions about the process which is driving the extremes. Quite often the assumptions are made that the data are in some sense independent, that they are stationary, that's to say the stochastic variation in the data remains pretty much unchanged over time. Now, in most applications, these assumptions are clearly not really valid. And it may be necessary, it's usually necessary, to worry about these aspects as part of the whole modelling process, so that the choice of model, the inference on the model, and the application of the model are taken into account at the same time as the possibility of dependence in the data, trends in the data, stationarity, seasonality, other forms of non-stationarity in the data. There's also the possibility of many processes being affected by what we call in the statistical terminology some covariate effects, so that one variable is influenced by the presence of another. And in that situation, the extremes of one process might be highly influenced by levels of some other process. My own area of application is more in terms of... usually worked in terms of sort of environmental applications, and a typical area there might be you're interested in extremes of something like a pollutant level, and in fact strong winds tend to disperse pollution, and so the extremes of the pollutant process are often influenced, diminished in this case, by extremes of the wind process, which tends to disperse. So quite often in a statistical context, the extreme value model is there as a basis, but it is just a basis, and it's all the paraphernalia that goes with it as part of a general statistical modelling process, which is actually just as important, if not more important, I would say. There are many other areas of activity in many aspects of extreme value theory which are under current research in the statistical community. And as David mentioned in his paper, one of these is the area of multivariate extremes, which is a difficult area under rather rapid development at the moment, so that we can try to build models that handle the fact that several processes might be simultaneously extreme, and particularly for maybe insurance applications, the concern is that several events, all extreme, may occur simultaneously. The other thing which I think would be considered very important on the statistical side, which I think is rather hidden in David's presentation, is the importance of uncertainty and the necessity of expressing the uncertainty in estimates that are made and presented. What I mean in particular is standard errors on estimates, confidence intervals on estimates, and I think this is especially the case in extreme value theory. And I have to say, it's not just... the statistical community is just as guilty as this as anyone else, but quite often these models are used and inferences are presented, and you know the result of an application is that some process we've just observed a 1 in 200 year event. There's no way we can be so certain that is the 1 in 200 year event. It could be anything between, say, the 1 in 20 and the 1 in 2000 year event on the basis of the data available. And I think, as statisticians and probably also as actuaries, we're killing ourselves if we pretend we can be more precise with the conclusions of our inferences than we really should be. And I think it's essential, and I think the statistical models are much more adept at presenting a range of plausible answers than they are in providing a single best answer. And I would never, ever trust a statement which said, you know, on the basis of our inference, what we've just observed is the 1 in 200 or the 1 in 2,000 year event. I just don't ever believe we've ever got evidence to be so precise about things. And I think it's, if we're doing serious science, we should be honest about the difficulty in making precise conclusions. In my own research, I've moved gradually towards a framework of statistics which you probably are familiar with, which is Bayesian statistics. This isn't the place, I guess, to go into that sort of debate, but I would just highlight it as an area in which it is rather more natural to include the uncertainty in the inference in making statements about conclusions about the results of an analysis. So my own personal work these days, most of my work is done within a Bayesian framework, within which it's rather more natural to include the uncertainty in the inference process. And I did notice a comment in David's paper, which I wasn't quite sure what he meant by this, but I'd strongly support it. But in paragraph 715, he wrote that actuarial science adds a further important layer with the concept of uncertainty on the prediction and placing a cost value on that uncertainty. And if that's a point in this direction, I'd strongly support it, but wasn't sure exactly what he meant by that. A couple of concluding comments. I think it's very easy to do extreme value theory badly, and very easy to convince yourself you've come up with something useful when in fact you haven't. And I think it requires a good deal of honesty doing extreme value theory, and I think it requires honesty to say, on the basis of the information we've got, this is the very best we can do, but it is the best we can do. It's not a definitive answer. And that might make things difficult, that might make things more expensive, but that's the honest answer. Just conclude with a couple of comments about computation. David highlights, references a number of different sources for computational tools for carrying out these types of analyses. One of these is something I've written, and the others aren't. What I wanted to say was that there are various techniques for doing the inference, estimating the parameters on extreme value models. I have a very, very, very strong preference for techniques which are likelihood-based, either through maximum likelihood or through Bayesian estimation. Largely because, there are many reasons. There are theoretical reasons, but the more important ones are practical reasons, that within the likelihood framework, it's much more natural to look for, estimate, assess the presence of trends, stationarity, non-stationarity, covariate effects, and so on. Also, likelihood theory provides an almost off-the-shelf method for estimating measures of uncertainty like standard errors, confidence intervals, and so on. So it's a very much richer, ready-made theory to which any modelling procedure, including extreme value theory, can be applied. Of the various packages available, the ones which do the modelling within a likelihood framework are my own and Alex McNeil's. And I'd like to say that for most things, Alex's is much nicer. I mean, the graphics are nicer, the interface is nicer, and so I'd like to sort of recommend his rather than mine, except in one aspect, which is that if you are worried about modelling trends and modelling non-stationarity, seasonal effects, covariate effects, my package, my software allows that, whereas Alex's is really just for the basic case where you assume the data are independent from a common distribution, no trend analysis, and so on. So that would be the distinction between our two sets of packages. The other thing I'd say about mine, David writes in the references, I think, that my package requires, mine and Alex's, require the use of the software language S+. And this was true, but I think both of us now have versions of our software which have been translated into a comparable language, which is called R, which is virtually identical to S+, except that it's free and downloadable. So, in fact, if you want to experiment with these, with both of our sets of routines for fitting these models, you don't have to pay. Everything is downloadable for free. Okay. Thank you very much.
Ian Reynolds.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, that was a slight surprise. I was expecting I might speak later when a few more of you had spoken on some of the technical issues, but I'll fill in the gap. I'm very pleased with David's paper because it took me back, I'm sorry to say, 40 years till I did a statistics degree. When we did study the Weibull distribution and generalized Poisson distributions, and I even bought Gumbel's book. And if there was an extreme value probability, I might go into my loft and I might actually find it. I think one of the things that strikes me of this paper is the extent to which this is an art, not a science. I think Professor Coles implied in a number of his remarks the extent to which judgment is necessary. And certainly as I studied under Professor Lindley, Bayesian processes seem more likely to be the way forward, where you put a prior probability on whether you're 1 in 20, 1 in 200, or 1 in 2,000 seems right. I think there are risks for the actuarial profession here. When Andrew Smith requests guidance, if Andrew Smith needs it, then I think we do have some concerns, particularly when we're expecting shortly a board for actuarial standards to actually give standards in this area. And I think this will be a very critical area for us and for the Board of Actuarial Standards as we go forward. I hope that one of the outputs of this is that David will organise some workshops, some real hands-on workshops. And I will say later about a series of data which maybe could be used in this area, because I think the key in lots of this is actually to get your hands dirty with the numbers. But it's not always easy to do it on your own, and I suspect that rather than continuous professional development, we may actually want to think here of workshops of being professional development before the continuous. So carry on the good work, David, but I hope that you will actually share it and allow other people at some stage to take advantage of your skills, your knowledge, your experience in actually working with the numbers. Now, one area in the paper, which is only a small paragraph, but I want to say a bit on, and this may prompt Paul Sharmer to speak. This is section 6.7 on operational risks. And I lived through what was probably one of the greatest operational risks in recent times, in having your head office blown up with the St. Mary Axe bomb. And maybe I can just remind you what happened on the 9th of April 1992. But actually, can I just say to David one slight thing? You actually describe in the paper the reason why Poole Re was founded was because of the St. Mary Axe bomb. I actually think the proximate cause was not the bomb. It actually was the withdrawal by European reinsurers of cover. But that may be just a minor point. So about 8 o'clock on the evening of the 9th of April, a bomb intended for the Stock Exchange blew up in St. Mary Axe and severely damaged St. Helens, the head office of Commercial Union. I'd been out that evening, I think somewhere else in London, and got back home about 10:15, switched on the news and saw the damage to the Barclays bank building just round the corner, and actually said, well, if that's the damage to that building, heaven knows what's happened to ours. I rang up my boss, and by then, already one of the general management team was on their way into London to assess what the damage was. Throughout Saturday and Sunday, the management team was split into two, three of whom were going to run the business for the however long it took, and three who were actually going to reverse, cope with the problems. They did sufficiently well that by 9 o'clock on Monday morning, it was business pretty well as normal, including the phones being answered on the Central London number out in our IT centre in Kent. And it was almost 2 years before we were back in the building, deferred by the second bomb in Bishopsgate. Now, there's an issue of connected events, and if the first was one in 200, what happens when the second one goes off? That might also be an example for you, for people trying to get their minds around numbers. Now, there was very little cost to the company. The amount of capital that the company needed for that operational risk was pretty small. Actually, there was an insurance claim, some of it which was self-insured, but a lot of it was covered elsewhere, and there was some increase running costs, but not significantly. And nothing to suggest that the capital to the group needed to be increased by more than 1 or 2% of what it was at the time. So an extreme event, certainly, but an extreme cost, certainly not. And I think the two lessons we can draw from this. One is we've got to be careful about assuming capital is the answer to operational risks. I think the lesson drawn from this is that planning and good management is much more significant. And I'm sure Paul will say the FSA has got that covered through its systems and controls issues. I'd also say, remember Eisenhower's words, and these were spoken when he was a general, not when he was president, and this was, in the business of war, I found plans to be useless, but planning essential. So I think the lesson was that we'd actually planned, didn't work out what the plans were, but we got the data to be able to cope with the situation. So this is an area, I think, for actuarial science, but for good management. Now, I said earlier, David, that I would mention some other extreme losses that you could use, and this is where I think Paul can actually say, fine, you do need capital to cover some risks, and this is the rogue trader. So it's trading losses. I'll mention three. I think there are more than this. There's Barings and the Leeson losses. There's the Sumitomo copper trading losses. And there's losses that the Allied Irish banks had. And there are probably two or three others, but I couldn't remember them this afternoon when I was putting these together. So I think there are extreme events that will affect the capital of insurance companies and banks, but broadly they are not what may well normally be called as operational risks, but more likely to be trading risks. Thank you for the paper, and I will go and see whether I can find Gumble.
Right, that completes my list of speakers who notified me in advance. Who would like to be the next contributor to the discussion? Chris.
Chris Lewin. I think this is an increasingly important area, both for insurable risks and for non-insurable risks. I'd like to talk about the mitigation of extreme risks. And I think, first of all, if you look at it from an individual's point of view, I'm just going to quote some examples of how people can mitigate extreme risks. An individual can take out insurance, but it's still unclear whether the insurance company will pay out in the event of a catastrophe occurring, causing many claims. An individual can avoid living on an earthquake fault or a floodplain or near a volcano. And, of course, if he's really intent on mitigation, he probably won't become a space tourist. What do companies do? They do things like studying near misses. They have a crisis committee, which is set up well in advance with clear authorities to act quickly and contingency plans to cover things like product recall. There is a study going on at the moment called Strat Risk, which is all to do with the ways in which organizations can manage their strategic risks better. And what is coming out of that is a point one earlier speaker made about the need to pay as much attention to process as to events. In this case, what process do you set up in the company to mitigate your strategic risks? And then governments, in mitigating their strategic risks, or society's strategic risks, can do things like, for example, using the precautionary principle for things like genetically modified foods. They can improve the emergency services, which mitigates a wide range of risks. They can keep an eye on earthquake tremors, near misses again. And they can even look for colliding asteroids, which is one of the subjects mentioned in the paper. This isn't as new a science, however, as one might think. The early fire insurance companies were formed in the shadow of the Great Fire of London, a truly catastrophic event, if ever there was one, when a lot of people lost their whole livelihoods. And the problem facing the early fire insurance companies was how to charge premiums, given that the normal experience was much less than the catastrophe experience would be. And the solution they came up with was to form the insurance as a small part of a capital investment scheme so that the expected profits on the insurance would increase the rate of return on quite a large sum that was invested. And in the event of a catastrophe, then there would at least be a large capital reserve to draw on. And clearly today, a great deal of thought is being given to the question of how far insurance companies can realistically cover catastrophic events. I think that leads on to the question, if you assume that they can't cover all catastrophic events, leads on to the question of how far society should bear extreme risks. For example, if London were flooded, as the paper mentions, to what extent should everybody else in the country chip in? And the paper in paragraph 7.8 mentions a number of schemes which have been set up in the United States to cover specific catastrophes. But one wonders whether perhaps, since catastrophes by their very nature may be unforeseen, whether there isn't a case for saying, perhaps in the UK, that where a particular part of the population suffers a catastrophe of some kind, society should supplement their insurance payments, which they receive, up to, say, 90% of their loss. Of course, if the catastrophe is too widespread, that might not be able to be afforded even then. But nevertheless, one wonders whether having some further discussion in this area in advance might help to solve what would otherwise be a very big dilemma when it arose. Now, if one were to take the approach of government backing up insurance companies in this way, or society backing up insurance companies, at first sight, it might seem that modelling would be less important because society wouldn't need to know the magnitude, or perhaps the frequency. On the other hand, there is, I think, still a case for modelling, because there might be some situations where governments can mitigate in advance. For example, how far should you build up the capacity of your emergency services? Obviously, there's an enormous cost involved in that. And I think one can perhaps try to make some logical judgments using the kind of theories which are mentioned in the paper to try and assess how often those extreme events might occur. So I think this paper is extremely interesting. I think it does very much lead on to the question of mitigation, and I hope that perhaps in due course there will be more theoretical work done on mitigation to try and help us all to cope with life. Thank you.
Paul Sharma from the Financial Services Authority. I deliberately waited so that I didn't speak immediately after Ian, because had I got up straight away, that would have given the impression that I was going to answer any of the questions he posed. I want to make a number of remarks with no particular theme running through my remarks, so I'll just pick off topic by topic. It will not surprise you to hear that my starting point is to ask the question, to what extent, if at all, might the modelling of extreme events be relevant to the regulatory standards that we set for insurance companies, for banks, etc. And this is, I think, a question that is right at the core of the potential reform of the insurance regime currently being discussed within the European Union, and at the core of the practical problems that we currently face when implementing the Basel II capital standards for banks, again within the EU and much more widely. Let me start with the insurance example. The current tentative proposals from the European Commission are that we should set a soundness standard, for the capital requirements for insurance companies at a 1 in 200 year event. In other words, that we should be seeking to achieve capital levels such that the occurrence of insolvency is, roughly speaking, 1 in 200 over a 12-month period. That is the what the political level within the European Union have said. The technical level within the European Union, which is primarily a working group led by myself, chaired by myself, I should say, rather than led, needs to find some way to actually operationalise that desire expressed by the political level. But our first and most immediate and perhaps most difficult challenge is actually to ask whether such a requirement has any meaning at all. In other words, do we actually know anything meaningfully about events that are that rare? Now, in one sense we do, because we've got, just look at the UK, I could make the statistically naive comment that we've got some 800 insurance companies, some 600 of whom are non-life, and we've got 10, 20, 30, 40 years of apparently relevant data. And therefore we can say, well, 800 insurance companies, 1 in 200 year standard, that means we lose, whatever it is, 4 a year or something like that. But of course, as you all know, the fundamental flaw with that is actually a point that a number of you have made in your contributions today and is made, I think, clearly enough in the paper, that these events are not independent. The extreme event that we actually are seeking to protect against is not just the extreme occurrence in an isolated or idiosyncratic fashion in one particular insurance company, but the concurrence of extreme events that actually threatens the whole system of insurance provision within the UK or within the European Union. And if we ask ourselves, if we think of that 1 in 200 year standard in that sense, we have to admit that we actually know very, very little about that kind of an extreme event. And that, I think, leads me on to the second issue which I want to raise, and I want to raise it in as non-technical language, and that is the fundamental question I think we face in creating a capital standard is to what extent is all of the richness of data and information that we possess about how insurance companies behave in a financial sense during ordinary times, to what extent is that richness of data and information about behaviour during ordinary or non-stress times, to what extent is that actually relevant? To what extent does that actually tell us anything meaningful about the sorts of circumstances that the non-ordinary times that we are actually primarily creating the capital regime to deal with? And that is, I think, a profoundly difficult question, and one on which we really have no ready answer. One of the straws to which we clutch when trying to address that question is, of course, the various techniques for modelling of extreme events. But we clutch that straw with a great deal of scepticism, a great deal of uncertainty, a great deal of lack of clarity as to whether it actually offers any real insight in for this particular problem. I make no comment as to insight for problems more generally. And if you like, that is going to be one of the major discussion points as we develop Solvency II. And that leads me on to my third point, which is I wanted to make an analogy with what's happened in Basel. One of the fundamental issues on Basel is, of course, Basel for banks, the capital standard for banks, is credit risk. And Basel purports to set, to calibrate its credit risk model to a 1 in 1,000 year event. Naively, when I first came across this, I naively assumed that that means that the UK banking system would survive the Black Death or the invasion of Genghis Khan or any other event that you have in the 1 in 1,000 years. But more seriously, when one actually looks at what Basel is doing, Basel then said, well, actually, we don't believe that individual institutions, individual banks, can in any sensible way model on a 1 in 1,000 year basis. Therefore, what we will do is require banks to model on a best estimate basis, on a centre of the distribution or a mean or a median, whichever you care to say, to model something to do with the well-behaved central bit of whatever probability distribution it turns out to be. We will then assume that this probability distribution is normal, that's the Merton model, and then we, the supervisors, or rather the Basel text, the law, will say here is the formula to convert own estimates that relate to the well-behaved bit of the probability distribution into a tail a number, because we don't actually believe that institutions, when it comes to probability of default of lenders, we don't believe that banks can actually model at that tail, or at least not yet, of course they can and do model at the tail, but at least we don't believe that they can model sufficiently reliably in the tail, or, what matters perhaps even more than reliability, sufficiently consistently at the tail from one bank to another. And the key question, if I come back to insurance, another key question in the insurance debate is, to what extent do we actually say, no, we don't believe yet or trust yet, or even if we believe in trust, we don't think there is sufficient consistency to rely upon the direct modelling of extreme events by insurance companies. No, instead we should be asking them to model some kind of model the well-behaved, the central bit of the distribution, and the Solvency II legislation itself, the Solvency II rules themselves, will take you from the centre to the extreme by some methodology that is almost certainly wrong, but equally is at least consistent from institution to institution. And as I say, that is a major discussion point on which I confidently expect, as the chair of the technical group within the European Union that is looking at this, on which I confidently expect a variety of views from different member states of the European Union. That leads me on to just one or two further points that I wanted to make in a more or less random order. Just very briefly on operational risk. I won't enter into the discussion as to whether capital is or is not an appropriate response to operational risk, not because it isn't an interesting subject, but I think it takes us a little bit too far off the nature of the paper. But what I will say is the paper does discuss the use of the modelling of extreme events in the operational risk context. And here, if one looks at Basel, one sees an interesting contrast. I said for credit risk, the direct modelling of extreme events was not permitted. You model the sort of the mean, and the Basel formula takes you to the tail. By contrast, for operational risk, the standard Basel is requiring of banks, if they wish to model directly — there is always a formulaic alternative, but if they wish to model directly — is go directly and model the tail. And there, all of the things, or some of the things that I've discussed, been mentioning earlier, and many of the things discussed in this paper and by other contributors, are proving highly relevant in the very difficult problem that banks and investment banks are having in modelling the tail for operational risk. I mean, the modelling challenge that Basel has set the banking and the investment banking industries is construct a capital number that has a 99.9% soundness standard attached to it. In other words, construct a capital number that is sufficient to absorb operational risk losses to that degree of an extreme. Needless to say, nobody can, of course, do that in those preciser terms as I've stated it, and Basel does create some language to suggest, you know, there or thereabouts, or roughly so. But nonetheless, there is a huge extreme event modelling challenge on which considerable resources are being spent by the banking and investment banking industries at present, and one in which it has surprised me so far that the actuarial profession has not become greater engaged, especially as a number of you have a perfect into this, in that you sit as insurance, as actuaries within insurance companies that sit in banking groups, and therefore interact with precisely the people who are attempting to do this within the banking group. And you can grapple with issues such as, again, an issue I mentioned earlier on: does the occurrence of the sort of everyday or every week type of operational risk failures, does that actually tell you anything about the extreme operational risk failure. Or conversely, you could say, is the lesson when one actually looks at extreme operational risk failures that they are really just the coincidence of a number of operational risk failures that, taken separately, would be an everyday type or an every week type occurrence, where the coincidence was made more probable by the presence of a poor corporate culture, and therefore actually data about everyday operational risk occurrences both helps you to model the tail and in particular informs you about the quality of the corporate culture, which is probably the key driver of the extreme event. The jury, as I think, is very much out on that question.